size of the ship. Just the motion that's in it.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
You messing with Gaza, you messing with me. Palestine all on my feet. I'm seeing my people deceased. They killing our children and even discreet. These murderers tasting our blood like it's sweet.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is STEMinism, and it's Friday, February 16th at 5.03 p.m. You just heard Friday, I'm in Love by The Cure. We're very excited to have you here listening with us. We're going to kind of divert a little bit away from the topic of more neuroscience this time, which we're really excited about. And we have a really exciting special guest with us today. We have Callista.
Hi, everybody.
So yeah, thanks for coming out, everyone.
We are all very excited to be here to talk about not neuroscience for once, I would say.
I'm also down to talk about neuroscience. I'm always down to learn new things. Perfect. I feel like I left bio a long time ago, but I'd love to be brought back into the fold.
We'll just go where the conversation takes us, I guess, right?
Yeah. So, Calista, would you like to give the audience a few sentences or a briefing about your background and what you do?
Sure, yeah. So, as they've said, I guess. I feel like I always go like, and my name's Calista at the beginning of a presentation. But, yeah, I'm originally from, sometimes I say Toronto, but technically Mississauga. I grew up there. I did my undergrad at the University of Toronto in engineering science because that gave me 2 years to decide what my major was, and I'm the most indecisive person that has ever existed. So in the end, I went with aerospace, and so that was what my undergrad degree was in, and now I moved to McGill, and I'm doing my master's technically in the mechanical engineering department. And yeah, my work, I'm in the group, it's called Computational Aerodynamics.
Okay.
Which
that
is sometimes,
fancy.
Yeah, it sounds really impressive. It's just like computer math stuff, a little bit of coding, okay. A little bit of math, a little bit of this, a little
that
bit of
still
that.
Sounds
that sounds
impressive.
Really cool though, yeah. Like girl boss stuff right there.
We're all girl bosses. But yeah, I guess that's a little bit of a background of mostly like my education,
cool.
I guess.
Yeah.
Nice.
So what exactly do you, like, what is your research on? And tell me as if I was like 10 years old, because I don't know anything about math or coding or anything at all.
Okay, so I'll start from like the basics.
Okay.
So
needed.
Like what would like a computational aerodynamics group do? So like we know obviously like when you're trying to design something like a car or an airplane or whatever, you have to model the fluids around it, like model the air around it so you can get an understanding of the way the air moves around it and like kind of the the lift or the drag or that kind of stuff, or like what kind of engine you'll need, all of that. So the point of computational aerodynamics is like simulating like a wind tunnel. So you don't have to keep doing like expensive tests where you like actually use like air around like a model in a tunnel. Computational aerodynamics is like modeling fluids around a body, but in a computer. So like if you've used like CAD before or something like that, it's like a software where you like 3D model something. This would be like a 3D model of a body in real life, but then the point is to model a fluid around it so that you can optimize it in some kind of way. So you want to design an airplane, so like let's say where the wings are, what kind of tilt they have, all these different kinds of design parameters that you can change on an aircraft. So that is kind of what the group does. My work specifically is in reduced order modeling, which is a way to, because obviously you have a lot of design parameters, so like a lot of things you can change on an airplane. I'm just talking airplanes specifically because that's mostly what I work with. A lot of things you can change. So it can be like really computationally expensive, which just means like takes a long time on a computer to run.
Okay. Like, what would a long time mean? Like years?
Could be, depending on how complex the airplane is, how much you include of the airplane, like how many degrees, we call it like degrees of freedom, so like things you can change inside of it are, or how many points around it you want to model and actually solve for. So yeah, like some of the, at the last conference I went to, some of the runs that people were doing took like a whole year.
That's insane.
Yeah, because it's like hundreds of billions of points that you're trying to solve for, like with these like really complex math equations that are already hard to solve for, but then like you want to do it like trillions of times around a body. So the problems I work with like are a lot smaller just because like I'm in like kind of like a research topic. I'm trying to run these like maybe once a day, like a couple times a day.
Well, absolutely.
So
if an algorithm takes as long as your whole master's, like there's really much you can do.
Yeah. That's why like a lot of those things are run by kind of more by like research centers or like national labs, because like NASA can sit there and like let something run on their computer for a year and just not go back to it, or like have a student like restart it every month, and that's like the that's like the student's job or whatever. But yeah, so they could be really, obviously they could take a really long time to run. So the point of reduced order modeling is to kind of like approximate your model in some kind of way, so that you can do it a lot more quickly. So there's like a lot of different math techniques that you that you use to do that. And so then like my job is studying like the different techniques that are out there, and then coding that up so that it's in our like software that we've built in-house.
Okay.
So it's like a little bit of combination of like just like computer modeling and then just like pure mathematics as well.
Does when you use reduced order models, like, does that affect the efficacy?
Yeah, for sure. So like a company like, let's say like Boeing or Bombardier would use that as like a first run of like, you're trying to do like a rough estimate of what you want your first aircraft to look like.
It doesn't replace, it just is like a first. Okay, that's so really cool.
Yeah, so in like, obviously, especially in aerospace, like whether it's like actual spacecraft or like an airplane, there's like really, really, really high levels of like accuracy that are needed once you like go to like the FAA and be like, I want this airplane certified, and like I know this like level of certainty on like all these numbers that I'm giving you, like how long it can fly for, like what kind of like all that kind of stuff. So reduced order modeling is always used as like a first estimate of like just getting like a basic, oh, like what kind of shape do I want, blah blah blah, those kind of things,
because you can rule out the bad stuff right away without having to wait a year.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to like waste a year on a model that's like never going to be useful, so
That's cool. That's neat.
What kind of computers does your lab use? Like, when you talk about how computationally expensive it all is, I imagine your lab being like just hundreds of massive computers
with like blue lights and sci-fi music playing.
Dark lighting.
The lights are normal. We have windows, thank God. But I'm really bad. Surprisingly, I'm really, really dumb about computers. I don't know anything. I just go in there. I know how to code. I know math. I don't know anything about computers. So my desktop's like a regular desktop that anybody else would use. But what we do have is access to like a cluster of supercomputers. So what that means is like not computers that are in the lab. All the computers in the lab are regular, like
normal,
like the one you would have here, maybe even less complex. But we pay for, or the university or the professor in a majority of these type of groups would pay for access to a really large set of like just servers of computers like somewhere else.
Compute Canada?
Yeah, Compute Canada. So we have access to Compute Canada. So we're running like really large tests on their clusters.
So do you like remote in?
Yeah. You like remote in and then you like queue up jobs, and then you have to like wait around.
Nice.
So the computers in our lab look completely normal. Just looks like a regular lab. But in comparison to like a bio lab, you walk in, it's not, it's like, it's a computer lab. Like it's a children's computer lab. Like when you used to go
in elementary school.
It's just a whole bunch of laptops. Like when I say I'm going to the lab, it's, I'm just
cool
going
math
to
math games for kids.
Literally, I'm going to do cool math games for kids.
That's so just funny. Your job, but like, like the adult version.
Pretty much. The closest you can get in an adult job.
That's so funny.
You know, it actually makes me feel so much better about all the time I have to wait to run my code. Like, I complain if I have to wait a day for something to run, and now I'm, like, actually very grateful for that. How much do you reduce the time, like, with the different methods you found?
Really significantly, but that's only because I'm running, like, really small, like, design cases. Like, I'm not... the things I've been running, like, I'm just, like, changing, like, an airfoil. So it's, like, a 2D case. It's not, we're not in, like, 3D yet. It's, like, flat. And then it's just, like, the shape of, like if you cut through a wing, what that would look like. And so that takes, like, I don't know, like, 24 hours sometimes. Or if I, like, depending on how accurate I want my solution. So that's kind of, like, what my work is in, like, how... can you set a level of accuracy that you want in the solution so that it doesn't run past that? It doesn't, like, do any extra computing that you don't need. So, like, yeah, anywhere from, like, 30 minutes to, like, 24 hours, depending on, like, what I'm actually trying to solve for.
So is the idea that you kind of find an optimal solution for different pieces of the aircraft, and then you put them all together so that you don't have to do like one giant grid search of the whole thing?
Yeah. My work hasn't really done much in terms of like optimization yet. So like solving for like the most optimal design, but that's the ultimate goal, would be to be able to use this for design optimization. So like you're solving for like different parts. Usually you would do like the whole aircraft, but...
That's cool.
yeah, I just, it's really complex. Like,
okay.
There's a lot of components that go into solving for the flow around an aircraft. So it would be difficult to start there as like a master's student.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think like more like the, like a PhD student could probably start solving for the flow around a whole
aircraft.
Okay. But it's just like you want to make sure like all your math models are actually running, so you're running even sometimes like really basic test cases like 1D just to verify like the consistency of your solutions.
Okay.
Just because like there's so many things that could go wrong like in your code or like the way you've implemented the math that like you need to do all these like many tests before like you get to being like, and this solution around the aircraft is good, don't worry about it, you can trust me.
That's super comforting to know that that's the level of accuracy that's required
in I think order it's to like in like once you're in an actual aircraft, it's like one in a million in terms of like how accurate your solutions need to be. It's like there's this like 10 to the 6 or something level of accuracy you need in terms of your like estimates for like lift or drag or those kind of things, so that like nothing's actually going bad when you're
These are the algorithms that take years to
Or then you're doing like real world like testing as well. So like in a wind tunnel after, you usually it goes like reduced order model design, then like full CFD, like computational fluid dynamics design with like higher order methods, and then into a wind tunnel, and then into like full scale testing. So that's like flapping the wing like a million times, a trillion times until it breaks, shaking the whole airplane until it breaks. So that was kind of what my other job was before in my co-op was in full scale testing, which is like like doing crazy things to it. Like it looks wild. Like it looks like, because the wings flap way more than you would ever see in like the real world.
Oh yeah.
That's crazy.
So to a physical aircraft, you're just trying to destroy it.
Pretty much, a real
life-size one, like a real one, just like a little model.
Real life-size one. At the NRC, they have ginormous hangars where it's like you could fit in a whole helicopter.
That's crazy.
And like shake the whole thing.
Did you just get to stand there and watch?
It was COVID. So I didn't see a single. I mean, I went into a couple of the buildings, but I never saw any of the tests. Okay. But I got to look at the data.
So you were looking at the data of it.
In my co-op, I was like post-processing data that came off of the full-scale tests.
So what kind of data did you look into specifically? Like, what were you trying to find from that data?
So I worked on like a lot of different projects where I was there, and like technically some of them I'm not allowed to talk about.
Fair. We're getting into the juicy stuff.
Was it military?
Yeah, it was. Okay, okay. Yeah, cool. It was government military work. A lot of it was like trying to predict like failures of different components inside of an aircraft before they happen, based off of load data. Mm-hmm. So like placing like strain gauges to measure how much something is like being kind of pulled apart, you know, how much load is being put on something somewhere, using that to then predict, okay, like this has been bent back and forth, or this has been shaken in this way, or this has hit this frequency or experienced this load cycling this many times, I'm expecting it to break in like the next 6 months.
Okay.
So we can adjust our like maintenance schedule to that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's kind of like I was kind of on two ends of the spectrum, where like now I'm at the very beginning of design versus that would be like the very end, but like is a necessary step still.
Yeah.
Like we're not at the point where anything from my work or anything even like one step higher fidelity would be accepted by like the FAA. Like you still need to do full scale testing, like no matter what, to get like an aircraft certified, which is good.
Yeah.
Which is good. Like I'm not one of those like we could do everything computer modeling, like we never ever need to do anything in real life ever again of people.
Yeah. Are there these kind of people in the field?
There's people who think it can get there, for sure. There's people who think like a lot of it can be replaced by modeling, which I think some of it can be, for sure, someday. But I don't think we're at the point yet where that's happening. Yeah.
So that Boeing incident, where do you think they faltered?
Oy.
The door? Yeah.
I think it's kind of a...
Whose fault was it?
I think it's kind of a political question, honestly. I think I'm maybe a little too politically motivated to answer that question. just because, at least from my understanding, I feel like I'm... I think a lot of people in that industry, in terms of just, like, straight up, like, commercial aircraft, have complained about a lot of the companies being under pressure from shareholders to reduce costs. And that's been a problem over like the past 60 years where 60 years ago, it was all about like the quality of the work you're doing, like the imagery of being a family and like all caring about the product that you had at the end of the day, versus now it's like, where can we do cost cutting and how high can we get, the like stock prices and how much can we give back to the people in C-suite and stuff like that, and how big can the packages be for that? So I think, in my opinion, which is completely irrelevant because I don't work in any of these companies, and hopefully they'll still hire me one day. Hi. I think that ends up being a problem where this was like an attempt at like using a vehicle, and I think it was also pressure from airlines because they wanted to add two more seats to where that emergency exit door was. And so it ended up being a problem where like you're doing a retrofit on an airplane of something you haven't really like done any of the full, at least in my understanding, like full testing of.
So they did these additions and then they did, so they already fully tested it and then they added these things.
And then, it was like an aircraft and then they're using it in a configuration that they were not certified for.
Oof. That's bad.
So they put the door, it was supposed to be an emergency exit, the panel that was put on, but they added two more seats where it was supposed to be like an aisle. Mm-hmm. And then added that panel where it was just bolted on, like where it was supposed to be a door. At least that's what my understanding of it was. I think it's just an issue of all of that politics that's happening there. And just like less focus on the quality of the product.
And that's like not just in aircrafts too, like iPhones and
everything
right now with capitalism and like planned obsolescence. I feel like that's just a general trend.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's like an opinion that's like popular.
I think it is. I mean, I feel like
for people in like they would share that. I don't know if they would, but for sure. It's definitely a problem in like a lot of different fields.
Yeah.
But I think like it's got to be the field you want that to happen the least. It's like
absolutely
the most highly certified, most highly controlled area almost of any industry. So it's like, why even like the other one where I can't remember, I think the where they were like straight nose diving, I can't remember what the plane was called. I don't remember.
When did that happen?
Oh, it was a while ago.
Is it the one they made a documentary about?
The Netflix
Chilean
the Uruguayan soccer team, the Uruguayan team.
No. Okay, I don't think it was that. But the one most recently was like again like a like shortcutting issue where they were trying to use a previous design and just like add new code, but like didn't tell the FAA kind of in a way, or like they didn't really like point it out. They were just like, hopefully they don't notice. And then it was again like it like crashed two planes, I think, like I'm pretty sure, but I can't remember what it was called, so that's really not useful.
This is really alerting me to check, you know how when you book a flight they tell you which plane you'll be on, like which design. Now I'm feeling like, okay, I need to do my research on these planes.
I mean, the door flew off when I was like the Alaskan Airlines one, when I was in Florida at like a conference with Boeing.
That's
crazy.
It was wild, and so it was so interesting, like we were just like looking at them, you're like, my prof, like when I was on my way home, he's like, make sure like your airplane flight on like that, your flight back isn't one of those airplanes. I was like, I'll double check.
I think they grounded a bunch of those planes after that happened.
They did,
like, is probably gonna be an issue with these other ones. I knew someone who was trying to get back to Canada and whose flight got grounded. So
that was like our friend Alexa was in Mexico during that, and she had a flight back to Canada on one of those planes, and they still hadn't canceled the flight, and she wanted to see like how long it would take for them to finally cancel her and like give her a refund. And I think it wasn't until like the night before the plane was supposed to take off that they finally canceled the flight because of that aircraft.
Yeah.
Which to me seems like an awfully long time to finally like decide to not use that plane.
Maybe they were waiting for people to jump ship. So that they could
not get money. They could say that
there's
that's
also
true,
like a lot
actually.
Of bureaucracy. Yeah. Like the airlines wouldn't want to do it if they didn't have to, unless the FAA
that's true,
like,
yeah.
told them they had to.
Yeah, so I didn't think about that. Yeah.
Until like somebody comes in and says legally you cannot fly that plane, they're gonna keep flying it.
That's scary though, right? Like.
Yeah,
like, why is bureaucracy coming in the way of safety and public safety for people who are getting on these planes?
Morality does not equal legality.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think also just, like, there is red tape for the purpose of it being safe. Like, there is, like, a law of, like, this person needs to sign this person needs to sign this, in terms of just, like, making sure everything actually is as safe as it can be. Mm-hmm. And nobody's, like, left as, like, the singular person making a decision about something. Mm-hmm. But that just means, like, maybe decisions sometimes are slower than they need to be, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is, like, such a random sidetrack, but when you're talking about people in your field, like, thinking about, like, everything can be modeled, I just was reading something really briefly today about how, like, they're trying to use 3D printing now to do, like build full-on buildings and stuff, and apparently there's, like, a bridge in Shanghai that's fully 3D printed.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I didn't know that. And that's also crazy. Kind of, that makes me kind of scared a little bit, even though maybe it shouldn't.
So the one I've read about, which wasn't 3D printed with plastic, right? It was concrete.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
plastic bridge.
I had to do a report about this.
Oh, you did? Okay.
In my undergrad.
Okay.
It was actually for an English class about technical writing, and we had to pick a topic, and I got assigned the topic of making sustainable homes, especially for people who are dehoused, and what is the most cost-effective way that we could find that. And we were examining two different solutions. One was using containers, reusable containers that can be converted into housing, and then the other one was 3D printing homes.
Okay.
And apparently 3D printing homes are actually quite, how do I say, efficient, given how fast they can put up the building.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
It requires a lot of reinforcements.
Yeah. Okay, because I was wondering about the actual like livability and safety.
Yeah. Yeah, it requires a lot of reinforcements. Like, people have to put in a lot of metal rods. If it's going to be a place where people reside in, they have to ensure that the way they 3D print it allows them to install like things like insulation, proper grounding, proper like structural reinforcements, and that has a lot of different factors that impact it, like where is this house being built, because the climate affects it, the material that they use, and what's the average temperature in this place, what are the extremes of temperatures that it could go to, like how do we ensure that the material we're printing is actually can sustain all this stuff.
That's interesting.
Very interesting. I haven't done much, like I did as much research as I needed to
for that
write
paper,
that paper and I just kind of tucked it away in my head, but I think it's definitely an interesting avenue to explore, especially nowadays, because there's a lot of people that have been displaced and probably need quick efficient ways to find housing.
There's actually little mini homes that you could buy on Amazon for
that you can are 3D printed?
Not 3D printed. I think they're just model.
Oh, that's like the Sears homes. Remember those? Or not remember, because we were obviously not born yet, but there was like these Sears homes that you could just like open a catalog and just pick which home you wanted to buy, and they would send you all of the like every single material down to each and every like nut and bolt that you would need to build this house.
Oh my god,
it's like
book of instructions for that.
Yeah, but there's like really cute ones, and like sometimes people will drive like down the street, like on TikTok, it's like big on TikTok right now, they'll show off like their IKEA or their Sears homes, and they're like really nice and like still standing like decades later, still great.
It's like the people just DIY'd it, they send them instructions for how to build the house. How did that...
there's instructions. Yeah.
In a little pamphlet with like pictures.
Yeah. It's like an entire book.
A novel.
Yeah. Pictures and no words, just like IKEA pamphlets.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Pictures with like dotted lines that show you screws magically landing in a spot and you have to guess how you're supposed to put it in there.
Yeah. Sam just texted me that his grandfather's friend in Nebraska built his own 3D printed home.
What?
And the walls and roof are all 3D printed and shipped from England. That's pretty cool.
That's insane.
I want to see a photo of that.
It's really hard for me to imagine that, just thinking about the dimensions of things. Like, you have your medium-sized 3D printer. Oh. I don't know how big they
are. There's a giant 3D printer.
There's ginormous 3D, like, room-sized 3D printers.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but still, like, for an entire house.
I don't think like, the, it's, like, all
I
one...
Think it's, I know, of course, but, piece. Like, how much...
That would be impressive.
I'm just imagining that in my head. That's so funny.
It's kind of like if you think of a 3D printer as a little tube with something that comes out of it, and it has to move on three axes. It has to move left and right, back and forth, and up and down. They would build like these large skeletons in order to make that movement possible, and they try to be as accurate as possible so that that tube can move in the right way, and then it's just a small attachment, so they could technically make the 3D printer as big as possible within, you know, technological and material constraints. That's they build the skeleton and then they attach this movie thingy that kind of moves
That's
around
cool.
and does that, which is wild because when I think of a 3D printer, I'm like, yeah, it's this tiny little thing that makes this tiny little plastic thing that I can take home. And it's like, no, like these things
like
can
machines.
Be massive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was talking to a girl in my lab today about 3D printers, and I didn't know this, but apparently, like, in biotechnology and, like biology, they're really excited about the idea of being able to 3D print with cells in order to make tissues. And I didn't even know, like, I didn't even fathom that until I talked to her about that today. It sounds like there's not great progress in that direction, but it's still, like, a really exciting direction to pursue. So I guess like my first thought would be like burn victims or something, like 3D printing with cells to make new tissues and like therapies and stuff. That could be really cool if we get there eventually.
Absolutely. And you don't have to worry about the skin graft, for example, being rejected because you're using that person's own cells to do the 3D printing. And actually, fun fact, 3D printing tissues exactly has to do with aerodynamics. It has to do with specifically it has to do with
full
space
circle.
And aerospace engineering, because in order to 3D print tissue, it has to be done in a zero gravity context.
Because
if they 3D print layers of tissue on Earth with gravity, it would just pull everything down.
Oh yeah.
And so you won't be able to build like whole organ structures.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
And so they recently were able to do it in the International Space Station.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
What the heck?
That's so interesting.
Which is a very interesting thing, and that's why like people always advocate for being able to go to space. And a lot of people say, yeah, but why are we focusing so much on going to space? We have a lot of problems to solve on Earth. And going there actually allows us to do a lot more things that would benefit us here, like making it possible to 3D print entire organs that people can then just use
like transplants.
As transplants.
So if you get a 3D in space 3D printed organ, you can say you've partially been to space.
Absolutely. You could say you're out of this world.
That kind of reminds me as well of like just a friend of mine, a close friend of mine, who worked on this project that was kind of related to like kind of all of that in a way, like a little bio-y, a little aerospace-y, and like how just like sometimes space does, like you're saying, get like a bad rap in terms of like it's really expensive and like what are we doing out there. But like I'm a big proponent for like more space travel and like more investment into that. But that's probably also selfish. But her work was in like studying, it was based off of like this twin project that NASA had done, where they had sent one twin out into space and then one stayed here, and they studied like the differences between them after a year. And there was differences. I'm so not good at bio, but something at the end of like your DNA, like telomeres, is that what
telomeres,
it's called?
Were they
so
shorter?
I can't remember who's, I think the guys in space were longer. So they were saying, like, what? This could possibly be, like, the secret to longevity. Never aging and, like, living forever.
Yeah, but you have to live in space, though.
Which was up. Yes. I was just reading, actually, today on Nature, there's, like, a review about, like, some new domains in life science, they're calling it. And one of them is called bioastronautics.
Wow.
Which is basically the study of the effect of space life on biological systems, including physiological and psychological effects on humans, mm-hmm. To survive and prosper, like, in space.
Yeah.
And basically what they're saying is like actually kind of the opposite.
Oh, where, well, it is very taxing on your body in other ways.
Yeah,
for sure.
Like they were saying that like research demonstrated that extended periods of weightlessness and radiation exposure can have negative effects on human body, including like bone density loss, changes in your immune, neural, and optic systems, and also like really intense psychological effects. Like a lot of people that go to space for extended periods of time get really depressed and anxious.
Oh, I can't.
And also
imagine.
Like really bad cognitive decline because you're not as stimulated out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're like, what the fuck? What are you doing?
Yeah, but what are you doing?
Yeah.
No, totally fair. But I think like. That was like a one very specific, like obviously like they studied like many things. It was like he, in many ways there was negative effects on that guy's body, like muscle atrophy, those kind of things. Obviously like
that's interesting about the telomeres.
But the telomeres, it was like one of the things where it was like we should look into that more than like.
But that's the thing with like longevity and aging research is like people, in my opinion, and I'm very a little bit jaded in that research area, I will say. But I feel like people that study longevity and aging will tend to pick on one thing that extends. Like seems to extend aging and just hone in on it and make it their whole career out of that, mm-hmm. even if it has drastically negative like other aspects. Like mm-hmm. for example, I was working in a worm lab for a little bit, and I was working with these worms that had we overexpressed different mitochondrial fusion and fission genes, and even though they were living like crazy long compared to wild type worms, they were like. They just couldn't produce offspring, and so their babies would hatch inside of them and like eat their way out. They were really slow, like they were slower than like the models of Parkinson's in these worms. They there's like in a lot of different metabolic states, they just like were way worse off than the wild type worms, even though they lived way longer. But kind of the big like what I felt like people from that lab were excited about was like, they live longer. We can write a paper now. And I feel like in general.
Oh yeah. No, that's scary.
Like a lot of that's longevity scary. Research can tend to sometimes hone in on the one thing that extends lifespan, even if it has other drastic negative effects.
Yeah.
So I will say that from my little jaded point of view.
Yeah. But I feel like that's a pattern in a lot of research areas.
That's
like
true.
If you look at medication, it's often like, oh, we found this and this effect. It's like, it's going to be the medication.
That's true.
And then only in the follow-up studies to that, or even only in the clinical trials.
Yeah. Or they only do it on men and it has terrible effects for women.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't work on women.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
It wasn't until 93 that women were required to be in clinical tests for
required,
drugs.
Required, that's insane.
In before 1993, can you imagine? It's so recent. Can you think of the health effects on women, on our parents, on our grandparents? Like all the drugs that they had to take, and the fact that they weren't tested on women, and they weren't required to be tested on women, is like some of them must have been tested on women if they were made for women. But like, who knows?
I was just thinking about that, like the pill.
Tested on men. It's like, I don't know. It doesn't seem pregnant to me.
Yeah. It's like I was watching a TikTok of this woman who's a dentist, and she went to dentistry school, I think, in like the 50s or 60s. And she was talking about how back then they only did like dental hygiene experiments on dental students, but they were all men. And she was like the only woman in her class. And so they found that like the average saliva pH of the average person is like 7.5, so very normal. And it wasn't until, like, this year that they realized that, like, women actually have way more acidic mouth pHs, which is why women are way more likely to get, like, cavities or, like different, like, mouth issues. But because they'd never, like, studied women's mental or, dental hygiene and, like pH of their saliva. Like, they didn't really realize this. And so women need to take different approaches to your hygiene when it comes to your teeth than like men do, but like we only just figured this out, and it's just like even just down to your mouth. That's crazy.
That's so interesting. That's the one product, toothpaste, where it's like not gendered.
Yeah, the one.
That's the one product where it's not dead, like deodorant gender.
Do we get pink
razors gender? Right. Maybe we need different pH level toothpaste.
No, don't put the pink tax on toothpaste too. Oh.
I will say my boyfriend uses black toothpaste, no. So I feel like that's kind. already like male.
Yeah,
the charcoal one.
Yeah,
it makes them seem intimidating. That's the only reason. Yeah.
Also, next time you kiss a woman, think about how her pH is more like the pH of her saliva is more acidic.
Just think like, about that. Mind. Yeah, happy Valentine's Day, folks.
Yeah. You're welcome. All right, well, I'm going to play a song, take a little quick break. By the way, all the songs that we're playing today are some of Callie's favorites that she sent to me, so I hope you guys enjoy. This is one of our favorite local Montreal bands, Fleece, Do You Want to Party?
Oh, hello. Who's that over there?
Once again, you are listening to 90.3 FM, CKUT. You are listening to Seminism. It's Friday, February 16th at 5:43 p.m. And we have our special guest, Calista, with us here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
No worries. I'm having so much fun.
Yay. I'm so happy to have you. So one thing that I was interested in, because we've ranted on this radio show so much about our experience as women in STEM and specifically neuroscience, so we would be interested to hear what your experience is like in engineering.
Sure. I think I would say I'm fairly lucky in terms of the experiences I've had so far. Like, I know this isn't going to be a universal experience, or that mine will be the same as others, and that obviously others go through a lot more challenges. But I would say my undergrad was pretty fine. I was in a program where they make an effort to kind of make it super diverse. Mm-hmm. So we were a 60-40 program-ish. So like 60% men, 60%, 40% women.
That's
which
amazing.
Which is like the highest percentage
that's wild.
Pretty much any engineering program in Canada.
Yeah.
So I think in my undergrad, I didn't really have a grasp of kind of what the issue was. I mean, like, I knew, I was like, oh, like, there's always all these groups, there's all these, like, or, like, older women, like, older professors who talk about it, and talk about their experiences, but, like, I was like, I don't know, I'm into my undergrad, it seems pretty normal. I mean, a little bit of bro culture, but nothing too bad. And,
were all of your professors male, or, like, do you have a really good mix?
I would say majority male.
Okay.
Professors, yeah. So that was the thing that I started to pick up on, was just like, okay, in the older generations, there's some challenges. And then when I got into probably the work environment is where I really, really started to notice it. I've worked in a lot of different industries. So I worked in like software a little bit at Bell as well, like Bell, like the telephone company.
Mm-hmm.
And there for sure, I was one of two women in the group. Okay.
How big was the group?
It wasn't that big. It was maybe like 25 people.
Okay, still. I would consider that big.
And I was like, I was there for the summer. So I was there for 4 months. So when I left, it was just her.
Oh my gosh.
And there was definitely like some weird things that I had to navigate just in terms of like the way they treated me.
Mm.
I've always been like a pretty, like, I feel like I can jump around those situations pretty well, and like try to like handle them as best as I can, but I did feel like a couple times like I was being like, you know, patronized a little bit, or not listened to as much, or like a person would, some of them would ask like funny questions, like they were very nice, and so like a lot of them were like not intended to be harmful, but like they would just ask like funny things that like they probably wouldn't ask a guy that they worked with.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think there's just like a couple, like maybe one or two, where it was like a really older person, like a really older technical advisor person on the team, where I was straight up like, oh, I really did not enjoy that comment. Like he showed me this like a clip of a girl and he's like, oh, she's so like aloof and like kind of like bubbly, just like you. Whoa. And I was like, I feel like I wouldn't describe myself
that's
as like
even bubbly.
Yeah, like either of those things really, like, or he was trying to say like she's just so like you know, like kind of all over the place. And I was like, I don't know if I feel that way about myself.
And like, he wouldn't do that to any of his male coworkers. He
no.
wouldn't be like, oh, I saw this
man reminds me of you.
Yeah, he's so aloof and bubbly, just like you. Like he wouldn't do that.
Not. Especially those adjectives. Like I don't think he would ever go to a man and be like, oh, he's bubbly.
Yeah.
Very like female or like directed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I definitely felt a little bit uncomfortable there. And then the other thing that I started to notice once I was more in the aerospace field is that just, again, like a lot of people in like senior positions are almost all male. The NRC, my department was almost all male. So it was more of a, when I'm at university or when I'm at like kind of meeting other engineers, like I meet a lot of other female engineers. I had so many friends in undergrad that were female engineers. Mm-hmm. I feel like on school and on campus in classes, like it doesn't feel that drastic. But then once you're actually out into the workforce again, you do start to notice it a little more, and you do start to kind of just like run into some semi uncomfy situations.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't had anything too crazy.
That's good.
Thankfully. But I know that like, obviously I also am like a lot of other things that probably help me. Like I don't have a lot of other intersectionalities. Considered. I know people of color who are women have even more of a difficult time. I haven't had anything, but I know obviously like I am aware that there is like a kind of like culture around that, and that like they'll talk a specific way. I think like the biggest thing I noticed was like, this is gonna sound so like feminist, like annoying girl. But like like there was I was at like a conference. It was like a virtual conference, and like all like the keynote speakers were like all old white guys who all in the kindest way love you all looked exactly the same, and like I couldn't distinguish between who was talking, and I was like, this is like the same person 30 times. Like there's no way, like if we want diversity of opinion, like we know this is a good idea to like have diverse groups have better outcomes. Yeah. Like, so it's just like, it makes no sense to me. But it like makes me, like sad a little bit that just like, damn, like, there's still so much more work to do for sure. And like, it's not a good thing that there's situations where like I did have to face like things or like experiences or feel uncomfortable, like that shouldn't still be a thing. But I think obviously like the work of past women who were leaders in these areas have done like so much, like leaps and bounds, and so I think like just trying to like acknowledge that and just be grateful that like there is more encouragement to for women to go into STEM. And we're seeing that in numbers in undergraduate programs. And I think that's great. But, like, I would be interested to hear, like, more about your guys'. Like, was there more, like, extreme negative experiences in neuroscience?
I would say in engineering, actually, in my undergrad back in Lebanon. I would say Lebanon has a few more strides to get to. Like, my engineering program did not have that many women in it. And so it did feel super... like it felt super male dominated. All my friends, most of them were guys, and so I felt like I was always trying to position myself to be like intimidating enough so they take me seriously and don't just like be like, oh, like you're like the girl here, like are you finding it difficult and something like that. So no, like I tried to position myself to be that way, but not too like unagreeable so that they don't see me as a peer. Like I didn't want anyone to hate me, but I also didn't want them to like not respect me. And that was definitely an interesting thing that I didn't realize I was consciously doing until I came to McGill, where I think there's a better diverse representation of students. I felt like there was a lot of things that I was actively like trying to be when in my undergrad, and I didn't really notice the effect until I came here, and I was like, wait a minute, interesting. Like it's
I think it just, it is tough that like women have a lot more things to balance in terms of the things in your head that you're trying to consider. I think I've always leaned towards trying to be, trying to use humor and trying to be a very personable person, but then I've been told directly that that can be challenged like by an older female, like by a more senior female, that, you know, that's great and all to be relatable and to be funny, she said, but be conscious that people will, like that other man said, like think you're silly,
like not take you seriously,
won't take you seriously. But then at the same time, it's an unwinnable thing, because you go the other direction and you're too bossy or you're too
absolutely
demanding. It's not that you're strong or confident or certain about your opinion.
You have to be the right level of both.
I mean, I think I'm lucky because I'm young, so I'm just like, I don't care if people don't really take me seriously. Like, it's like, whatever, as long as they like.
It's a different culture now, definitely. I think we care a lot less.
Yeah.
We have bigger things to care about.
For sure.
There's a neuroscientist, Sheena Jocelyn, Dr. Sheena Jocelyn. She gave a talk at Cannes. And what I loved about her presentation, she was the keynote speaker and she was doing a presentation about Engram cells. And she like literally said she wasn't taking herself so seriously, and she was like adding jokes to her slides and something. And I could sense that all the other people there, specifically like the male presenters that were presenting before her, were like, like she just did that, and we were like trying to be so serious and she just did that. And I think I really appreciated that, like about her, like just having fun and not letting that dictate.
That's so cool.
And I think that was one of the best talks at that conference because of her presentation.
I had something interestingly very similar at the last conference I went to. It wasn't a woman, but a man gave a presentation where the whole conference is, oh my goodness, like an aerospace conference. Like, it could be so heavy math, could be so like this, like it's really mentally draining. And like, if it's such a big, like that one was like 3,000 or like 4,000 people, so it's like a lot of topics you don't know anything about. But he made like a concerted effort to like, he's probably one of the most impressive, like some of the most impressive like research work that was going to be presented that weekend. Mm-hmm. Like, people know him, people came to his presentation specifically because they know his actual research is interesting. But he had no problem like making the whole thing like a journey about how, like, you know, you have to like make mistakes to then know like what the mistake is and ask, know what the right questions are to ask. Like, he made the presentation a journey and like made him like made people like laugh during it. But it was like still super like interesting, and people obviously still take him seriously because he's intelligent, his research is impressive, and like you don't have to like be so serious. Like.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it was like,
I think that's like definitely the best way to go about communicating anything. No one wants to listen to someone who's just monotone and kind of sounds like they're not fun to talk to or be around. I don't know. So I don't really understand this culture of wanting to seem super, like, we get it, you're super impressive, but that's not the best way to get information around.
It's like, I'd rather learn and have fun than like just sit through a dry presentation of you, you know, vomiting all your knowledge on me. Like, I want you to make it, like, I want to remember your presentation. And
considering how important it is in research or science to present your research in a like comprehensive way that even lay people can understand, we're very badly trained in the whole thing, and like our what are supposed to be role models are sometimes so horrible. Like,
also, most just personality-wise, right? It doesn't always gel. Scientists and engineers, brilliant people, but a lot of them do not know how to have an have a conversation with someone else that doesn't revolve around science or...
Well, I mean, if you're in academia and you're doing the whole thing of working 60 hours a week, I mean, how are you going to practice social skills,
It's an impossible balancing act for everybody. We are all just trying to figure it out.
Well, it's the end of my 60-hour week, and it's the end of STEMinism. So thank you so much for tuning in. Sorry to, like, just kind of end it really quickly, but we have people who are waiting to start their next show. But yeah, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This has been STEMinism. We're every third Friday of the month, and we have a really great special guest today, Callisto. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was absolutely so much fun. Wonderful to hear you talk about this. I had so much fun.
I hope I didn't get too technical.
Absolutely not. You did such a great job.
Oh my God, thank you. And also, if anybody who's actually an aerospace engineer listens to this, erase everything I said.
We're going to end the show with a really good song. I love this song. Thanks to Callista's recommendation. This is Wawa by George Harrison.